Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 9 and 11 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Good morning. This is NPR News. I'm Chris Farrell, in today for Carrie Miller. The association of aging with inevitable decline has deep roots. Older people, they're stuck in their ways. Memories fail. They stop learning. Thankfully, research tells us a very different story about aging, the brain, and learning. Neuroscientists, psychologists, and other scholars have found that the brain changes in ways, good and bad, with time. The bottom line? You can adapt and learn new tricks. Lately, I found myself watching videos of Mark Knopfler and Slash talking about their guitars. Now, I never played guitar, but who knows? So to dive deep into continuous learning in the second half of life, we're joined by two experts. But before introducing our guests, I'd love to hear from you. Are you learning a new musical instrument in the second half of life? What is your experience? How about a foreign language? Give us a call at 651-227-6000, toll-free 800-242-2828, and online at talk@nprnews.org. Now to our guests. Dr. Dana Turin is Professor and Associate Dean of the College of Arts and Sciences at the University of North Carolina, Greensboro, and she joins us by phone. Welcome.
Hi, Chris.
I'm glad you could join us. And with me in the studio is Jean Siles from the McPhail Center for Music. She's a guitar and ukulele instructor. Glad you could be with us.
Thanks for having me.
So, Dana, just start off with you. What is the research telling us? I mean, do we keep learning throughout our lives, or is it really the rare person, you know, like the neuroscientist Oliver Sacks? You know, he was still writing these wonderful essays in his early 80s.
Yeah, I think the research, Chris, tells us that older adults can and do learn new information throughout their lives. Sometimes that learning is a little bit slower, but what seems to be more prominent is a change in how people learn and whether they put themselves out there and take advantage of opportunities to learn new skills and information.
So one of the words, when I was looking at the research that keeps coming up, is the word suppler, that the brain is suppler than the previous images. What does that mean?
Right. Well, I think that what that information tells us is that the brain is plastic to some extent. There's some flexibility in how we learn information and how the brain processes information. And older adults can compensate for some of the neurological and cognitive declines that occur to an extent that we didn't realize before. There's work showing that there's new brain connections being made and cellular growth that's occurring throughout the lifespan to a degree that we just didn't understand when our technologies weren't sophisticated enough to pick up on them.
So the trick is to keep using your brain. I mean, there's that, what's that old expression, use it or lose it?
Right, yeah. I think that there are benefits both for people's mental abilities to stay active, but also for just general well-being, to be out there and to socialize and to, really get as much out of life as you can.
So, Jean, what is your experience? I mean, you know, learning a musical instrument seems like a young person's game, right? I mean, you're in elementary school, you might be introduced to band, parents go out and they rent an instrument for their kids. What is your experience? Is it never too late to pick up an instrument?
Yeah, I don't think it would ever be too late. It's so much fun. And yeah, you might learn a little bit slower, but you might be retired and have more time to practice. And you might learn something that you never thought you could. Maybe your old teacher told you you couldn't do it when you were in sixth grade because you don't have the ability. Yes, you do. And you can still learn it and have fun with it.
And I understand that you taught Stuart McPhail.
Mm-hmm.
The ukulele?
Yes, I did. For a brief time, he came and joined my class. He was very positive, and he did quite well, of course.
And how old was he when you were?
Oh, I know he was, I always try not to think of age when I'm teaching students, but I'm pretty sure he was over 100. Okay. He was up there, maybe late 90s, 100.
So when you're teaching someone 50 and over an instrument versus someone who's younger, is it the same techniques? Is it the same approach? Do you make some adaptations?
I do adaptations. I make sure to ask them what they want to learn. Do you want to learn to read music or do you want to play? So they'll often do tab, a way of reading music without learning how to read music. Or I'll ask them, you know, if they have any visual problems to figure out how to get around those, or arthritis, different hand exercises to warm up to make sure that they physically can chord the chords.
So let's go to the phones. And first we're going to go to Kathy. And Kathy, you're in St. Paul?
Yeah. And I am 70 years old and learning how to play mandolin.
So, okay, so why the mandolin?
I bought it at a garage sale. But besides that, I mean, piano and organ, I play everything that you can possibly do. But The guitar, I have small hands, I cannot play guitar because I can't get some of the chords. But the mandolin, when I saw it for $5, said that I think I can do that. And so now I'm starting off with mandolin from square one.
And are you enjoying it?
Oh, I love it.
So, Jean, what's your reaction?
I love it. I'm jealous. I want to learn the mandolin, too. I think it's fantastic. And that's why we chose the baritone. I'm regularly a guitar teacher, the baritone ukulele we started with, then the tenor, because it is a lot easier, especially if you have small hands or some limited ability with your joints and everything. I say it plays itself compared to a guitar. And how is the mandolin?
So the tenor and these are all different kinds of ukuleles?
Yes, the tenor is tuned like a guitar, and I'm sorry, the tenor is tuned like a regular ukulele, but the baritone is what we started with, and that's more like a guitar. But I like the sound of the tenor concert in soprano more, so we switched.
We're going to go to another call, but first what I want to do is just say, you know, if you're in the second half of life and you're learning a new skill, a musical instrument, painting, a new software program at work, starting your own business, which is certainly a creative enterprise, give us a call, 651-227-6000, toll-free 800-242-2828, online at talk@nprnews.org. And let's go to Debbie in Maplewood. How are you doing, Debbie?
Good. How are you?
Good. So what's your story?
I have played, I started taking violin just about 4 years ago. I had wanted to play violin when I was in third grade because my dad played it, but they told me that way they didn't need violin, they needed clarinets. So I learned how to play clarinet back in third grade up through college, and then I didn't play anything for all these years. And I said, you know, I'm gonna try the violin. So it's been challenging because at least with the clarinet, you just covered holes.
Right.
And here, you're challenged by having to hear pitch a lot more challenging because you have to really key in on that and then learn that muscle memory of where your fingers are going to go. So I'm having fun, but I had to pick one of the harder instruments. So.
You definitely picked the harder instrument. So do you go to classes or do you have an instructor? How are you learning it?
I started out at McPhail, and that was great, and I was going to downtown, so it became a little bit more challenging for me, and now I have another instructor. So I've been keeping up with that, and I think as an adult, too, it's hard because you know what it's supposed to sound like, and so you're impatient. And you know, I tell you, I've got so many years left to learn this thing. It's like, let's get going. But no, it's fun, though. I'm having a good time. I think the challenge for my hands are, you know, used to doing certain things, so putting them in positions, it's a little challenging, and I'm glad you brought up, like, the exercises that you can do to get those hands to kind of be a little bit more flexible.
And are your friends doing the same thing, or are you sort of out there in this sort of unique space?
You know, I'm surprised. I have a friend who picked up mandolin and also violin, and there are a few other adult students out there that actually have picked up the violin or other instruments, whether it be guitar or something similar. So it's interesting. I'm glad to see that. So I'm not alone.
No, you're definitely not alone.
I play in an orchestra. Yeah, I actually play in an orchestra, too. So it's not anything glamorous, but we travel to different nursing homes and have fun.
So, and you get to perform.
And we get to perform, which is what we, you know, which you get the enjoyment from.
So, Dana, I want to ask you off of this, you know, back, you know, thinking about the child's environment, and there's all these activities that are set up to learn. You know, for me, as a new grandparent, I'm very excited to be getting Duplos. I realize I'm a little bit early on the Duplos and the Legos, but, you know, all this sort of learning environment. And so is part of this creating an environment for adults to learn in the second half of life?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely key. I think, you know, really making it evident that these are things older adults can and should do. So, you know, you mentioned early on that we really characterize things like taking up a musical instrument or learning a new language or, you know, taking up, you know, any sort of, you know, artistic or you know, skill. New skill as being something that kids do. But I think the more people become aware that older adults can do this and can benefit tremendously from these experiences, the more society will acknowledge and people will acknowledge that this is viable and this is a really great idea for older adults. And you know, things like these classes that Jean is holding, I think are really a key to making older adults aware that you know this there are no obstacles in terms of learning. It's really about how you approach it and being willing to put in the time. And again, like you were saying earlier, older adults have a wealth of time that they can put in to learning. So it's a very different approach than it would be when you have kids learning a musical instrument for the first time.
Okay, this is a little bit of an unfair question, but I get to ask it anyway, just because it's so large. But why is it that this image that, you know, you get to be 50, 60 years old, that you just can't learn anymore? I mean, why is that image so powerful, that stereotype so powerful in our society?
Well, I think some of it's just historical. I mean, you know, we've seen in, you know, fairly recent history, huge increases in both, you know, longevity and also the healthy lifespan. And so I think that, you know, people have really been freed up to do much more as they get older. You know, we see that older adults are, we have a lot more awareness of what older adults are doing. We see older adults as sort of a vital part of our society. And so, you know, I just think that there are historical roots in those sorts of stereotypes. And the more that people are exposed to, you know, what really is the norm, which is a, you know, healthy, independent, you know, very functional and active older adult population, the more these types of barriers will decrease and we'll realize that those stereotypes are just that and are largely sort of myths.
All right, let's go back to the phones and Betty in Minneapolis. How are you doing, Betty?
Good. Thanks for a great topic today.
So what are you doing? What are you up to these days?
Well, I just got back from a wonderful month-long trip to Japan, but for about 6 months before I left, I worked to learn a little bit of Japanese, and it was incredibly challenging.
I would imagine. So why did you decide to learn Japanese?
Well, I've learned from other trips abroad that if you learn even a little bit of the language, it really pays off because the people that you meet seem to appreciate it, and you're able to make more connections with people where you're visiting. But this was, I think, one of the hardest ones I've ever tackled, and it was incredibly humbling. I almost gave up several times. I had lots of resources and help. I ended up hiring a tutor for about 8 sessions, but it just felt like I needed so much repetition for things to sink in. Compared to other things I've tried to learn in the past.
Well, I mean, this is wonderful. So why didn't you give up?
Because I had a plane ticket, and I knew that it would really help, and it did.
Yeah. So, Jean, I'm curious. This is not a musical instrument, but this persistence, this perseverance, and really the confidence to keep doing it. I mean, do you encounter this with musical instruments?
Oh, yes, I definitely do. I just had, in one group lesson, I lost two students because they said it's just not fun, it's frustrating, and I'm not going to be able to do it. But it was only the second lesson. And I thought, oh, that's a bummer. They should give it a little bit more, but I also understand. I think it was the first caller was mentioning, you know what you want it to sound like, and you know what it's going to take to get there. It's easy to give up. I get it. I don't fault them, but I think it's important to really give it a try, and I don't think you'll ever regret it. I'm sure the caller didn't regret all the work she put in to learn that language on her trip.
Well, on this self-consciousness about you knowing what something should sound like and being very aware that it does not sound anything remotely close to that.
Mm-hmm. It will come in time. Just don't give up. And I like the ukulele group classes because we're all in it together.
How many are in a group?
It depends on the semester. Right now I have 5 in my group.
Okay.
And I'm teaching 3 different groups. I have 3 in one, 5 in another, and about 6 or 7 in the other group class.
And do the students help each other in the class?
Yeah, they're really, pulling for each other, saying, that's okay, that's how I started too, because they're at different stages of their lessons. And we learn so much from each other. It's the ukulele to me is an excuse to be more social and meet other people that are brave enough to try something new. Usually my classes will start at a residence place with 3 students, and the next week more will creep in and more will creep in because the word gets out that, no, this is fun, it's not scary, and the teacher isn't going to grab a ruler and slap your hand like they used to way back in the day. So, yeah, it's really fun, and they do support each other.
Well, let's go back to the phones in Stan. Hello, Stan.
Good morning.
I understand you're in Parrish, Florida.
I am now. Okay. I moved here a couple years ago, but I'm a lifelong Minnesotan and try to keep up with everything going on in Minnesota at the same time.
Oh, that's great. So what are you up to?
So last summer I saw an ad for the University of Southern California Graduate School of Social Work doctoral program, and looking for something to do in retirement. I applied, was accepted, and now I'm a second semester doctoral candidate at USC. They have a real innovative online classroom system.
Mm-hmm.
So it can be done long distance.
And do you go to the USC a couple times a year, or is it all done online?
I go one time per year for a week. That's coming up this fall. And then you go out to Washington, D.C. for the final semester for a week.
And let's see. So how old are you now?
75.
75. So you're going to get your doctoral degree. And then do you plan on using this in the workplace? Or what are your thoughts about, you making this investment?
Yeah, it's one of those ready, fire, aim situations that I get myself into from time to time. I did it for self-preservation and lifelong learning reasons. But once you get into it, you discover that they want you to actually use your learning, which is not all bad.
No.
So I will graduate when I'm 77, and I plan to pursue the major emphasis of my coursework after that. It probably will be in a policy framework of some kind.
I think that's wonderful. Dana, just one of the things, he gets to one of my minor pet peeves. I have several pet peeves, but one of my minor pet peeves is why colleges and universities are so much 18 to 24 and not more multi-generational institutions. I've interviewed people here at the University of Minnesota getting degrees in their 60s and 70s, but they kind of stand out as unusual. And my suspicion is, just what Tom is doing is there's a hunger out there to continue learning and to get some sort of feedback on your learning.
Yeah, I actually think it's more typical than you might be aware. We have at University of North Carolina, Greensboro, every year we have examples of people who are very similar to your caller in terms of having come back and just being interested. We have a doctoral candidate in history right now who's post-retirement. And again, is just interested in the knowledge that he can gain. Many universities also have programs for older adults to come in, and not necessarily toward a specific degree, but just take classes from, take advantage of the expertise in the universities. And so I actually think that there are a lot of situations where older adults come back onto a college campus and become involved. And I think it has benefits both for those individuals, but also for the younger students. And of course, I mean, the reason most of the university population is in their early 20s is because that's the more sort of typical time for students to just sort of continue their education before they enter the workforce. But I think it also benefits those students a great deal to take advantage of and sort of hear from the wisdom and expertise that the returning students can bring to the classroom environment. So it's not, you do see these stories because they're salient, they stand out, but I think probably every university has could point to examples of people who have come back, and they're often your most engaged students, and they really add something to the classroom.
I would imagine as a professor, it can be quite exciting because they probably ask very good questions.
They do, and they sort of model a degree of dedication to the other students that's also helpful. One class that I often teach is a class on the psychology of aging, and you can imagine that class is really attractive to people who are coming back to school. And, the other students just really soak up the perspectives that they can offer. And so they're interested in getting a more scientific perspective on the experiences that they're currently having. But of course, our younger students are also, inevitably going to get older, and they have, they live in the context of a family where they have, parents and grandparents, and they're interested in understanding a scientific perspective on what typical changes are as we get older, and what we can and should do to really live life to the fullest.
I'd like to talk to Tom in Eden Prairie. How are you doing, Tom?
I'm doing great. How are you?
Great. So what are you up to these days?
Well, I was telling your assistant that I retired January 1st, and I decided to join the church choir. And after a couple of months of that, I decided I want to take voice lessons.
Mm.
And so I have a Facebook high school classmate of mine on Facebook, and he's agreed to give me voice lessons long distance. He teaches. I think it's like opera at the University of South Carolina.
Okay.
And I told him I would exchange golf lessons for voice lessons.
Long-distance golf lessons, though. I like that. So if you don't mind me asking, how old are you?
Yeah, I'm 75.
And you just retired. So what were you doing?
Yeah, my training is in accounting. I was an accountant for a manufacturing company in Hopkins.
Okay. And do you want to be singing opera type music, or what kind of music do you want to be singing?
We have a great church choir at Pax Christi in Eden Prairie, and it's sacred music mostly. And, I'm singing the bass part, so I don't always get to sing the melody. That's a little frustrating, but anyway, it's I think the voice, I was told, was the best instrument of all. Stradivarius and so forth tried to emulate the human voice. And
yeah.
And it's free. I mean, and you always have it with you.
This is true. Gene?
Especially when you barter golf lessons. It's
yes,
really free.
I love that.
That's great. Yeah, that's one reason I love ukulele is it really encourages the seniors to sing. Again, a lot of them come in and say, I can't sing. And after a while in
the group
class,
many of them were told when
they
were younger that you can't sing, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, very much. And I haven't run into one yet that can't sing. I'm not a trained vocalist, but I sing. So we all end up singing in the end, and it's a lot of fun. And I know they realize, I guess I can, and kind of imagine. I wonder if I would have started singing sooner where I would be.
Well, you always have that moment, I sing in the shower, but, you know, is that necessarily what I want to be subjecting other people to?
No, they're literally, they can all sing. I'm not saying, I mean, they might not have a beautiful operatic voice, but they can definitely carry a tune. So I love it when people sing. Even if it's not perfect, I think it's great.
And how do you keep people who are self-conscious about their singing or their playing? I mean, how do you keep them engaged and say, you know, look, keep going?
You know, I don't say too much. I try not to put attention to that, the self-doubter. I think just being around the people in the group, they realize that, oh, well, they're doing it. And they get over it and they start singing. Or they might just say, this one is not in my range. I'm not going to sing it. Okay. And I just move on. So I don't want to put pressure because I understand if they really feel they can't sing.
Yeah.
But they usually end up singing and doing quite well.
All right. Well, we're going to go to Greg in St. Paul in just 1 minute. But first, I just want to say that if you have a story to relay to us, an experience, something you're learning new, 50 and over, give us a call at 651-227-6000, toll free 800-242-2828. And now let's go to Greg.
Hi.
So I understand that you're flying.
I learned to fly airplanes. I have a private pilot license, and now I'm getting my instrument certificate.
And is this something new for you or something you'd done when you were younger and now you've picked it up again?
I didn't do it until I was about 67, but I had a public school teacher in fourth grade who taught us how airplanes fly. And I think that was lurking in the back of my mind for a long, long time. And as I approach retirement, I'm now retired, I really wanted to do something to keep on learning, to keep me excited about life. I completely agree with what's been said before, that learning is really important for older people to keep them vital and healthy. And this has been a ball.
You have made the day. If my colleague Bob Collins is listening to this broadcast, he's an avid flyer and he loves the flying community. Is that part of it also? Are you becoming part of a new community?
I was really blown away at how important that is and how fun it is. I belong to a flight club. I don't own a plane. So there are 40 pilots and 3 planes. And being in that flight club is being in a community of learning, of safety, of people helping each other. A couple of them are instructors. One of my instructors is in the club. He's a Delta pilot. So the information that I'm getting from other people and support is just invaluable. It's just wonderfully rich.
Well, thank you. Dana, I want to ask you this. You know, a lot of times we and I'm doing it, you know, talk about learning and the individual and picking up some new skills and being engaged. But so many of these activities and Gene, what you've been describing, these classes, it's also part about community and not being isolated.
Yeah, I think that's a critical benefit of new learning and new experiences. And we know that that social engagement is really important to aging successfully and just living successfully and having good quality of life at any age. And so I think that these types of you know, of training opportunities and learning opportunities that are really rich in that way, that have, you know, social components and physical activity components. Those are the ones that are going to be most broadly beneficial for people, especially for older adults. And it's a sharp distinction from the sort of, you know, massive industry of like brain training games, which, you know, the sort of marketing savvy of telling people, you know, hey, play these games on a Nintendo or on your phone, and that will make you mentally sharp. And there's really not much scientific evidence supporting those sorts of claims. And I think that feels like homework to older people when they're doing that type of work. But in contrast, learning an instrument or learning how to fly, I mean, how exciting. And, you know, those types of learning are rich and are multifaceted, and I think are more beneficial anyway.
And do these have implications for employers? We have an aging workforce and we have an aging population overall. So is there a message in this conversation for employers?
Well, I think maybe the most critical message is to undermine those stereotypes of older people are not capable of learning, or, you know, they can't engage with technology, or, you know, the idea of being sort of over the hill or past your prime, or all these sort of cliched ways we have of talking and thinking, that there's, I mean, those are just not, you know, accurate characterizations of our older adult community. And so there's a lot to be gained. The benefits of an older worker's wisdom and motivation and dedication far outweigh the sort of small differences in the speed with which they'll learn new information or new technologies. And it's just, frankly, worth the time to invest in that.
So let's go back to the phones and Judith in St. Paul. Judith?
Yes, hi.
So I understand you're learning the flute?
Well, I picked it up in school many, I'm 77. I retired at 75. I had played the flute in grade school and high school. And then I, in college, very little. And then I was in a religious community where they did not allow any instruments. So I didn't play it for 30 years. And I came out and I did a little of it, but when I retired, I got bored after 2 weeks and needed something to do. So I picked up my flute, and I was pretty sloppy, but I asked the St. Paul Chamber Orchestra flutist Alicia McQuarrie if she would give me lessons, and she said she certainly would, and it has been absolutely phenomenal. I have picked up so many skills. It's been a joy for me, and other people who've heard me have given me much encouragement. I use it sometimes for the elderly people that I still visit. It's just a delightful thing, and it has encouraged me to use skills such as exercise. I've had to improve my upper body strength and walking and keeping my lungs, you know, in good condition. I do a yoga class because of this, you know, need to keep on with my flute skills. So it's been a joy.
So, and what did you do? So you retired at 75, you said?
Yes. And then I had a job, a wonderful job as a chaplain, hospice chaplain and a hospital chaplain.
Okay.
And I just thought at 75, I was pretty much finished, but I'm finding there's a lot of life after that.
There is a lot of life after that. So, Jean, this is, learning the flute, there's a lot of physical demands that are going on.
There is. I've never played. My sister used to play, so it makes sense that she's walking more and trying to get more breath. I know that the flute takes a lot of air to make a good sound, so good for her.
Yeah, and the thing that I also find interesting is, so you're learning a flute, but then that leads to doing yoga, in order to support what you're doing. So again, there's all these sort of spillover effects.
Yes, absolutely. And I love that she plays for elderly residents. I often will bring my groups out to play at memory care units or whatnot, mm-hmm. and just share the music and how much fun we're all having together. It's really fun. So good for her.
So do very many people that you work with end up joining some sort of local band or ensemble or, doing something on a Friday or a Saturday night?
And out of my ukulele groups, I know a few of them, after taking the introductory to ukulele, have gone back to the piano. They realized, you know what, I can do this. They may have studied it when they were younger.
Right.
And they learned, you know what, I have musical ability. I'm going to go back to my piano. And other ones, I honestly don't know. I don't keep too close.
Right.
Another Judy that I worked with, she learned enough ukulele where she does go and teach at the memory care unit at her residence, which I think is awesome.
That's wonderful.
Yeah. She loves it. And she jokes, you know, if I make a mistake, they won't remember. So I'm going to go share my music. I think it's wonderful.
And people do learn?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. They learn. They're always shocked. Sometimes they even cry. They can't believe what they're still capable of doing. It's really wonderful.
So Mary. Mary is in, you're in Minneapolis, right, Mary?
I'm in Minneapolis. Yep. That's right. Hi, just wanted to comment. I took up the sport of competitive rowing at the Minneapolis Rowing Club at age 50. I'm now 63 and have enjoyed 13-plus years of wonderful adventure on the Mississippi. It's a great way for adults to socialize and to show their competitive edge. Minneapolis has a wonderful rowing community.
It is a wonderful rowing community, yes.
Men and women combined. We do separate out and then have a competitive men's team and a competitive women's team. But we have in the United States a very active master's age, which is basically late 20s to 80. I mean, I row with people, women that are in their 70s that are very competitive. So it's a wonderful sport. Taught me a lot about my own sort of centering and where I need to be in my own space and then creating that environment with others. So it's a great individual thing and it's a wonderful team building experience. So rowing, and I learned it as an adult. So we do offer Learn to Row programs for adults to come and try it out. So it's kind of a little plug here for Minneapolis rowing, but it's a wonderful sport.
My youngest son was a rower for the Minneapolis Rowing Club for years, and it was wonderful. In my sense, Minneapolis Rowing Club, the St. Paul Rowing Club, the various rowing clubs, that they're extremely welcoming.
Exactly. And again, the older adult don't have to be, there's some that choose not to push it themselves to the competitive level. And we compete at a national level, even international level. But then there's some that just want to row the Mississippi and be content. And that's wonderful, too. So
great.
I think it's great.
So every once in a while, my East Coast roots come in. And I'm not exactly sure how to pronounce a town in Minnesota. But I believe it's Nisswa. And Lisa?
Oh, hi. Yeah,
hi.
This is Lisa. I am 62 years old and I am still working. And I love my work, but about 4 years ago, I was promoted to a new position at my employer because kind of they were desperate. There were some.
And what kind of work do you do?
I work in financial services.
Okay.
And most of my colleagues are at least 25 to 30 years younger than I am. Everyone seems really, really surprised that I'm successful at this. And although my boss has been great and supportive and helping me along in my career, I don't get selected for leadership positions because I think it's assumed I have gray hair and that I'll be retiring soon. I really don't have any intentions of that. I love what I do. So I think there is a certain bias.
Yes.
Towards younger employers and perhaps in financial services towards younger men. So it's a real frustrating situation because, within dollars, I was the number one producer in my region for a large employer last year, but no one really recognizes that.
Yeah, and one of the terms that sometimes people have told me that they become invisible, even though they're doing a good job and it's recognized they're doing a good job, they become increasingly invisible with age. Is that kind of your experience?
Not invisible necessarily, because, you know, I don't want to speak badly about my employer. Sure. They're a great place to work. But when there's an opportunity to serve in a leadership role or take on some additional responsibilities, I think it's always in the back of people's minds that I'm not going to be around for very long. Yeah. So why would they make that investment? They have no idea. My grandmother lived to 102, so I may be around for a very long time.
Well, I'm glad you called in. Thank you. Dana, age bias is a real issue.
I think it's absolutely a real issue. And I think with the sort of increasing visibility of people who are doing a great job and who are, you know, staying in the workplace and are learning new technologies and skills, you know, hopefully that will decrease over time. But I think it's important to not sort of let yourself be invisible and to have what might be sometimes, you know, awkward conversations, but to acknowledge, to say, hey, I think this might be happening. And just for the sake of clarity, I'm not going anywhere anytime soon. And I'm interested in these types of opportunities. There also might be an expectation that somebody's kind of winding down at the end of their career and aren't interested in these types of opportunities. So, you know, without being sort of aggressive about it, to just say, hey, in case this is why I'm being passed up for these things, let me just put out there that I am interested and I do think I can do these things. And maybe that would help not just a given individual, but also the people who will be in the same position in, you know, 10, 15 years.
Yeah. So let's go to Lewis in Minneapolis. Lewis?
Yes. I'm a 77-year-old road cyclist. I'm head of a local bike club called the Major Taylor Bicycle Club of Minnesota. And I've been doing it actually since my mid-40s. But I ended up, retiring 11 years ago, and I spend a lot of time on my bike riding fast.
And you enjoy it?
I enjoy every moment of it. And we get to, you know, we travel nationwide and ride with other clubs. And I ride at least 2 to 3 times a week, and I really do enjoy it.
And so are there real benefits to belonging to a bike club? Because, you know, people can just get on their bike and, you know, take off on their own. But what are there – would you recommend that people join a club, be with a group, even if it's not a formal club?
Yeah, it's important to be able to socialize with folks. And many of the folks are in the 50 and older age range in our club. And we have a little group in the club called the Old Geezers, and we're all over 70.
Well, I guess you get to use the word term geezers, don't you? Yes.
I guess so at my age, yes. And our club is an African-American-based club, but, of course, we have lots of white riders as well. But we really do enjoy one another.
I think that's wonderful. That's great.
And, Chris, step in and say one point that I think is important to make, and that we haven't yet, is the benefits of physical exercise for mental health and for cognitive preservation as people get older. Even just walking, there's a great deal of evidence that the just walking, just being physically active, benefits your whole body, including your brain health. And people see, you know, increases in alertness, and we see, neuroscientists see, improvements in structure and function that occur when people are active. So I think the social aspects are really important, but just being active has huge benefits as well.
And we tend to, or I think a lot of people do, you know, we sort of think there's physical activity, there's mental activity, but the research is showing, just as you're saying, is that, you know, physical activity has mental benefits.
Huge mental benefits, and really more benefits than mental activity in some ways. I mean, there's a lot of research trying to look at brain training and mental training, and none of those effects are as impressive as the physical exercise research that I've seen. In terms of just how broad-based the benefits are, all aspects of mental activity – seem to improve to some degree when people are physically active. And it's important to sort of recognize and acknowledge that your brain is a part of your body. So when you increase blood flow to your brain, you're going to see improvements in that organ. And that's going to lead to improvements in attention and memory. And again, the quality of life improvements that come out of that are really important.
Yes. So, well, it's Mariana in Rochester. Mariana?
Hi. Yes, I am 57 years old. And 3 years ago, I started doing tango when my younger daughter went to college. And it's really interesting what you were just saying about the physical activity, because I found that tango is an incredible way of, you know, helping with all of the new things that they call about neuroplasticity and all the new neuropathways that you have, you know, you can create. And the community that you built, I belong now to the Tango Society of Rochester. There is a Tango Society of Minneapolis. And it has been great also because it is my heritage. I'm originally from Argentina. And that has always been in my bucket list. And, you know, dancing, moving. I'm also a yoga teacher. And I'm a software engineer. I work in a neurology lab here at Mayo in research. Then doing all of this has kind of put together so many components of how a person could continue being active, healthy, mentally, physically, emotionally. And I think that dancing, and in my case, tango, puts everything together.
Yeah. And so what else is on your bucket list?
Oh, I would love to go to, like, travel to India or Machu Picchu. Those are things that I would love to do. And I think I'm going to continue exploring other types of dancing, like West Coast Swing. Several of the people that dance with me tango, they do West Coast Swing, and it is so much fun. It's a great also way of interacting with people. And then I think I would like to go back to play the guitar. I used to do it when I was younger.
Okay. Yeah, I'm in the camp that never played the guitar. That may well, we'll see. May possibly get there.
And, you know, another benefit of all of this that I find is that my kids are 21 and 24, and they love it that I'm doing new things. They kind of see you differently. They just get you out of being just your mom.
Right. You're a human being. You're a real human being. You do things.
Yeah.
Yes.
A person that is interesting. Look at what she's doing, which is super nice.
So, Jean, do you find that, I mean, I know you teach ukulele and guitar, but do you find that your students, they end up, they're doing other things, I don't know, learning dance or, you know, that leads to other activities?
I don't think I ask too many of them. Usually a lot of them have done an art classes. But physical, by the looks of them, they seem to be very active. I think the fact that they're seeking out a ukulele class, they tend to be more just active and engaged with the community. So, yeah, I think it's great if you want to barter tango lessons with guitar, I'm there.
You're there.
I love that she's doing all of that. It's fantastic.
So, Dana, just have a very quick answer on this one. But are we literally rewiring our brains when we're learning new things and we're being physically active and attempting to, you know, to play the ukulele?
Absolutely. I mean, that's you know, every experience you have, your brain is a part of. And so the improvements that you see by being social, by learning an instrument, by being physically active, we see those in the brain, and they're going to sort of follow you throughout the rest of your life.
So we have a little nice little ending to this hour. We're going to close this hour with music from Minnesota native Billy McLaughlin. He relearned how to play guitar left-handed in his 40s after developing a neurological condition that affected his ability to play right-handed. So thank you. Dana Turin is professor and associate dean of the College of Arts and Sciences at the University of North Carolina. Greensboro, and Gene Sales is music instructor with McPhail Center for Music.
This was a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to our discussion, you can call in at 800-242-2828 or tweet Kerri at KERRINPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all of our shows by subscribing to this podcast. If you have questions, you can email us at talk@npr.org.